I like to say that I don't really have a career. I have more of a careen. I kind of fall into things.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tammy Chaos.
And I am Rick Tarosi, and we are mildly interesting people. So because of that, to keep you entertained, we go out of our way every week to find wildly interesting people to chat with. Now, these folks may not be familiar to you, but rest assured, they're famous to us. Kimmy, who is our guest this week?
This week, we are joined by Dan Hahn. And there are two important things that I want to talk about here. One of them is that he takes stupid walks for his stupid mental health. And I want to get into that. But the other thing that is probably a bigger deal and more important is that he is a person who works in technology, but always puts people first. I went and read through his LinkedIn recommendations and reviews, and Dan, like every person who's ever worked with you loves you. You're like a beloved human. Fantastic. That's how I was going to say.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. They can't type or talk anymore. So it's really hard for them to leave reviews.
That's a really good way to approach it. I like it. So Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How did it come to be that you worked in technology, but were so human-centered?
You're starting with a really easy question there.
I am. Yeah. I just wanted to like...
Not very deep. We're surface level here.
It's like 10 past 11 in the morning. I've just managed to get the kids out the door. And the kitchen and the dining room is a
and I'm hitting bonsai. Hard.
Yeah, and you're like, okay, so explain your temperament and your life's work.
Briefly, keep it brief.
So I would say the boring bits are that I grew up in a Asian immigrant middle class family in the UK. So my parents immigrated to the UK from Hong Kong. My dad and my mum are both academics. So we were very lucky in that I was in the kind of family in the home where my dad would excitedly bring home a computer from work, from university. And then so he'd first bring back a BBC microcomputer, and then it would be successively bigger and bigger things as his influence and stature and research grants allowed. So it got to the point where, you know, and you kind of, I don't know, there are kids and there are people who like this who will just suck up everything around them. And the thing that I had around me to suck up was 80s and 90s copies of Byte magazine and PC magazine, and being a very, very irritating, precocious young kid who would, you know, break his dad's computer by trying to mess with the auto exec and config.sys to get Wing Commander working properly off pirated floppies. So that part is probably, I would say, familiar to a bunch of people who listen. The other part, I don't know. My wife would say that I am very sensitive and I have big feelings. And I remember a long time ago that there are things like really believing in institutions at the time, like the BBC. Like, this is a thing. So it's kind of like a weird British patriotism thing where, you know, there have to be institutions that exist that benefit all of us. And then, you know, as you grow up, gradually becoming disillusioned with them or understanding how things are a lot more complicated than why can't we just do the right thing all the time? And how what you think is the right thing ends up being very different as you grow up. And you understand what the right thing means to different people and who doesn't get counted when we say what the right thing is. So I just had kind of more and more opportunities to do that. And I would say accidentally found, I guess opportunity is the right thing, because I had opportunities come up where that kind of desire for the right thing to happen in the world, combined with my love for tech, were able to kind of coincide. So I like to say that I don't really have a career. I have more of a careen. I kind of fall into things. So I like to think that this kind of course of just caring deeply in a certain way to my ability about people and how the world is, combined with what I see about technology and the promise that technology should be able to bring. You know, over the last 8 years or so, there's been quite a lot of disillusionment about, okay, well, you know, when I grew up, we were supposed to get these things. And it turns out that they actually made quite a lot of other things worse.
Thank you for that context. Listening to you describe that experience, it reminds me that there's very much a generation of folks like us who were dissecting technology, for lack of a better term, to understand how it works and to integrate it into our lives at a time when it was very early. Fast forward to today, and in many ways, that technology is now dissecting humanity, trying to figure out how it works and those kind of things. Can you talk a little bit about your point of view on tech's integration with humanity and like where you see this next wave of kind of AI hype going?
Another easy question. Yeah,
another easy question. Again, now it's only 11:15 now. 5 minutes have passed since.
I gave you time to warm up.
There's a good. Erin Kassane has been doing some great writing about, I think, an aspect of this right now, which is to deal with different social networks and looking at Mastodon, for example, and the ActivityPub federated network. And one of the quotes that keeps coming up, not just from her, but from a lot of people who do a lot of thinking in science and technology and society, is the quote that technology is neither good nor bad, is neither good nor evil, but it's also not neutral. And I think there were these, you know, I don't know if it was kind of like post-atomic age, but also weirdly set against the backdrop of nuclear winter in the 80s and 90s, where it was technology is going to deliver us and it's going to deliver abundance and it's going to do all of this stuff, especially computers and software and all of that. And I think that the way to think about technology, the easiest way has been to be that it's a tool, it's a thing that we invent or we discover and we invent to achieve aims that we set in place for ourselves, or that aims that we're able to set so far as we can in the environment and systems that we're in and to the degree of agency that each of us has. So when someone like Mark Anderson says software is eating the world, you know, he's kind of describing it as, well, we made a thing that can do that, and I'm going to use that thing to accomplish goals X, Y, Z. So it's really... As I get older, and I feel like at least a lot of my friends or a lot of the people in the same bubble as me feel this way, it's like, well, technology, computer technology, software, stuff that allows you to do all of the maths very, very quickly at once, you know, massive operations at scale, they let you do capitalism more and harder. That's kind of what it comes down to. And you can put guardrails. Some states can choose to put guardrails on that or guide it or have principles around it. But ultimately, I think it's this idea that the more data that we have about something, the more that we are able to control something. And I think I kind of offhandedly wrote about this the other day. It's like for people who are in their 40s now, you grew up and then when you're around, you know, 8 to 14 years old, or 6 to 14 years old, you encounter a computer and then you can make it do stuff. You know, the Y Combinator chat talks about this. It's the power of, you know, writing code and then feeling like you're a god and then stuff happens. And then inevitably, I feel like that desire is going to extend from the confines of the screen to the network and then to the wider world. And it's like, well, if I can control a computer this easily, then why can't I control, I want to be able to control the world that easily. Just a story about us ever since we've used fire or stone tools or whatever. But then your question was about, okay, well, what's it like when it tries to control us back, or when it tries to understand us better? And again, I kind of see one of those shortcomings as it can only you know, the data that goes into those models, to the extent that we understand them and we're capable of understanding really complicated second, third order effects and so on, it's only ever going to be as good as the data structures that can go into the model. And we've made some really naive assumptions about things like, you know, there's all these lists, you know, falsehoods programmers believe about names or dates or times and things. And as we try to pull more of the world into these models that we can manipulate, then there's just some, you know, there's a really easy joke that I can make about gender that used to be stored as a Boolean, right? Or gender is just a bunch of enums. But really, you know, it's kind of becoming clear that it may as well just be a float or a series of floats or something like that. So, and even then, you know, it's continuous and it changes over time. So it's kind of there. We talk about building these applications, these apps and these services that we make increasingly in an effort to understand ourselves so that we can, I don't know, make more money or create more shareholder value, or which, or, you know, afford healthcare for a relative who has cancer. Right. We do all these things and we kind of feed it all into it. And it seems to me that there's always going to be this disconnect, because it's just a fundamental disconnect between the world just isn't like that. The world is fuzzy and you can make certain predictions about it and they might get better, but you can never really get the certainty that a lot of us strive for or need, which might strive into mental health walk territory, now that I come to think of it.
I was like trying to pick out something to not ask you the next question, just like deeply spiritual or mental health or, but you're making it difficult for me because you are talking about this in such a transparent way. And I think it's something that a lot of people allude to things or avoid entirely. And I appreciate it. It's not often that I get to talk to a group of people in my same age range that had the same experiences growing up. You grow up with books. Like when I was a little kid, we'd go to the library. And then I got a little bit older and my father started working in technology in the company that he was at. And computer devices started showing up. Mm-hmm. And like, there are two kids in my household. One of them wanted to play games on everything. And then the other person wanted to literally dismantle. I wanted to dismantle everything and put it back together. I just wanted to see what it looked like inside the case. So some of what you said, and this reflects where I am as a human right now too, kind of like pushes me over to the spirituality side of things. Mm-hmm. Because spirituality used to come from books and from oral tradition, right? Mm-hmm. And we would form groups and organizations. And it seems like, and I didn't know I was going here this morning when I woke up, but this is where I'm going. It seems like, I don't want to use the word cult, but it seems like, for lack of a better word, technology has allowed us to form these like cults and these sects and these groups of people that so deeply believe in something that we would have reserved for, like, I'm an Apple user, and there's right. like the cult of Apple, and yeah. like, you know, the watch, and then there's the computer, and there's the iPhone, and I don't have a spiritual religious belief in Apple, but like it touches and informs so much of my day-to-day life that I might as well. I don't know if there's a question there. I might just be talking, but like I may have talked myself into a circle. I just wanted to know what your thoughts are on that, because you grew up in a very analog little, and then all of a sudden the computers, and then once we get past just the computers themselves, we get into what that has meant for all of society to be connected through the computers and through the internet. So, yeah. What do you think? And then I'll let Rick ask you a really easy question, or we'll talk about mental health blocks.
I honestly think we're not ready for everyone to be connected in the way that we have been.
Yeah.
And, you know, which can sound super paternalistic, because I also really want everyone to be ready, and I really think everything at the very least could benefit from being connected. There was an essay I wrote a long time ago now about how, you know, if you'd gone back and you'd said, you're not going to believe me, but like over a billion people are going to be all online on the internet, and they're going to be talking every day, and they'll be doing it from their pocket, you know, the whole story. And if you go back and you tell 1990s me, then I'll be like, are you fucking shitting me? Like, really? Like, okay, that's awesome. Like, if you put it in that way, it's kind of like we won. Like, we got what we wanted. And to say that there was either naivety or let's just call it optimism in what would happen. And this isn't by any way to discount all of the wonderful things that have happened because people have been able to talk to each other. But I think, especially with something like Twitter and what Elon has done to Twitter, or what was already happening to Twitter and what was kind of already apparent with Facebook, I think, was especially with Facebook, there is no, you know, community of Facebook users when you get that big.
Yeah.
You know, there is nearly, I would say, a community of Redditors where there's kind of like a kind of Redditor gestalt, which has been purposely guided by actual humans showing up. Like, I think one of the big differences between Facebook and Redditor there is Reddit is that Reddit moderators show up and they talk in a user, admittedly, you know, quite unprofessional and not really great for the company tone of voice consistently. whereas Facebook is like, no, we're run as a business, you know. Yeah. And just the viability of a public square when we want, well, I say we, a bunch of people want different things, and the planet kind of isn't there yet. And which isn't to say that there shouldn't be a public square, but maybe the attempts to make it so are just so difficult that we're still at the stage of, you know, large groups that occasionally talk to each other and that where there's overlap. I was going to say, I mean, on the spirituality side, so I have two kids. I've got two boys. Our eldest is 10 and a half. And I mentioned that my parents moved over to the UK from Hong Kong in the 70s, where they had, you know, my brother. So we grew up in the UK, and the UK, for all of the Americans listening, is notable in having a state religion that no one believes in. So, you know, everyone is normally, you know, a member of the Church of England, and you've got the Anglican Church and all of that. And if you go to primary school, there are very high chances. I went to a regular non-religious primary school, so, you know, up to the age of 11, and you just sing hymns in the morning, and it's just normal, right? And it's not a big and it's because it's like because it's God, you know. What does God? God doesn't really. God's not real, you know. We just have to sing songs in the morning, and then everyone kind of makes fun of it, and it's just, you know, in the background, like the way Eddie Izzard kind of makes fun of English vicars and all that kind of thing. And the reason why I bring this up is because now my kid is old enough that he's actually reading a lot more about Chinese history through young adult novels. Those young adult novels happen to be written by young authors who are themselves immigrants of Asian families who are trying to make sure that it's easier for other immigrant kids to assimilate and to feel like they belong because they never felt like they belonged anywhere. Because one mode of immigration is when, you know, you've got parents who kind of double down on assimilation, right? So they don't want you to know anything about that. They kind of purposely, you know, not in a bad way, but, and it's not like they're intentionally concealing it, but perhaps your culture or your history or your traditions aren't really highlighted in that way. So I bring this up because I don't have I don't even know, for example, how observant or how spiritual my parents would be or are when they were growing up, you know, only to the extent that I remember when I was probably 8 or 9 going back to Hong Kong and then seeing my grandmother light some incense at where her dad was buried, I think. So I think about that, and I think about that kind of spirituality, you know, that kind of traditional spirituality. And then I think about having macOS release install parties where we would go to the Apple store in London and get together and then hang out in someone's flat and then all install the DVD or the multiple CDs, as it was at the time, right? Onto little white iBooks or those flaky metal titanium PowerBook G4s. Mm-hmm. And for that community, some of the people who hung out in that flat that night still hang out in a Slack right now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you kind of, one of the things that tech has let us done is it's let us bring a community with us rather than kind of be dispersed into the wind. Because Cammy, it was when you were talking about Apple, and it was like, okay, right, well, you know, if I see another Apple person, then, you know, back in, I don't know, back in 2001, 2002, you might see someone with white headphones on and you might say, ah, you've got an iPod too. Whereas right now it's like, you've got an iPhone, like, you know, 200 million other people.
Yeah.
Right. So it does feel like, I don't know. I've never read Bowling Alone or anything. My wife grew up in a small town, in small towns in the Midwest, to the extent that her family has their name in one of the churches in the town church stained glass window. That's how much integrated they are. And then my wife will say that she's not particularly religious, but what she did get was the community that small church congregation bought, because everyone would go there. You would know about everything. You know, I've gone along to their services when they have them, and they're all generally nice people, apart from that one time when someone was accused of rape. And then, you know, everything kind of closed up a bit. There was a lot of disappointment, strong disappointment all around in terms of what it meant for standing up for people. But we were talking about spirituality and tech bringing us together.
Yeah. But that's the thing, when spirituality or tech brings us together, I mean, there are always horrible, we're humans. Humans right. sometimes do horrible things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dan, you've touched on this a couple times, and so I want to just spend some time with it. Recent internet history aside, the vast majority of all of our experiences online have been the written word, be it short form, long form, what have you. You've touched on your writing a couple times. Like, as someone who has written online for a terribly long time, I'm always super impressed with not only the amount of content you create, but the fact that it always contains incredibly intelligent and cogent thought, but also as a reader, there's an inherent subtext of catharsis there.
Like, oh my God, yeah.
I have to get this off my chest, right?
Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about writing and what that means to you. And like, has that always been part of your life? Is that something new you found? Like, just talk a little bit about writing.
I'm pretty sure it's always been a part of my life. Like, I can remember again, I could, you know, it's all those kind of like memories. Like, I can remember childhood memories of writing stories on my dad's typewriter, and then progressing from a typewriter to a compact LTE 286 in WordPerfect. Actually, maybe even Word before Perfect. That in WordStar, on a different one. And wanting to write, you know, I think I've persistently for about over 30 years now written really bad pastiches attempting to kind of write something a bit like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas. Like every single time I try to write something like that, or I've been inspired by something like that. And honestly, it's actually taken me a great deal of therapy. So, you know, maybe 20 odd years to even come close to admitting that I enjoy writing and it's nice, and to be able to accept a compliment when people say that they like my writing. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting to kind of hold that denial alongside what, again, a therapist would point out to me is the clear evidence that I have to write just because of how much I write. And you know, and again, you know, I would kind of complain to my wife and say, but I'm not a writer. You know, I have friends who are writers. And she's like, no, you're a writer. You have written a stupendous number of words. You just don't do it in a form of a manuscript that is then finished and then sent to an agent or anything like that.
I decide with your wife on this one. You are a writer.
So I've written when it was FTP in mm-hmm. Notepad, and it was FTP uploaded to an FTP server and your web page had a tilde in it. And I've written when it was Blogger, and I've written when it was movable type, and I've written when mm-hmm. it was WordPress. And then I tried to get my head around static site generators and then just gave up. And even GitHub Pages on a custom domain pisses me off every single time I try to do it. I did Tiny Letter. Mm-hmm. You'll both know. So I started my newsletter on Tiny Letter when I was bored out of my skull at Wyden. And I was in one of those phases where all of our clients were just had made clear that they weren't really interested in interactive work anymore. So I had a little bit more free time on my hands in the office, and I did it as a way to both keep sane, and also the way I told myself was it was just like a practice. It was just like, I'm going to see if I can do this 5 times. I'm going to see if I can do this every weekday. And then honestly, I get trapped by it. So when Substack came along, first Substack came along, and then I got an email from this guy, Hamish, and he's like, I'm launching this new paid newsletter thing. Do you want to try it? And I'm like, no, I've got a Tiny Letter. Why would I want to do that? That'd be weird. And then 6 months later, he raises a bunch of VC and is like, oh, I've still got this new Substack thing. Do you want to talk on Zoom or something about how it might work? And I'm like, okay, fine, maybe. And then I'm on Substack for a bit. And honestly, one of the worst and nicest things has been people being able to pay me for the newsletter. Mm-hmm. Because it is, you know, still legitimately surprising that anyone would do that. Which, again, my therapist likes, because my therapist is like, but Dan, this is cold hard evidence that people actually value your writing. And I'm like, but it's shit. But they don't. But they disagree.
Your therapist likes the word evidence the way my therapist likes the word evidence. There's no evidence of that. There is evidence of this.
Yeah.
Hmm. I think I needed to hear that today. Thank you.
There you go. and then at some point, and this happens, one thing that I've had to learn, or kind of slowly had beaten into me, is remission in mental health. So I had a very, very difficult time, and I went into intensive outpatient for, I have no idea how long. I don't know if it was 6 weeks or 8 weeks or however long. And for people who don't know, intensive outpatient is when you don't want to be in hospital. And they agree that you don't have to be in hospital, but they really want you to be doing something. So it's structure. It's a bit like daycare. You go like, yeah. you get taken there 4 days a week, and then you're with a group of other people, and then you also do things like art therapy, which was horrifying to me as someone who thinks that they are terrible at visual art, and then suddenly be in a group with, 10 to 15 other adults, and it's like, okay, now paint your feelings. Like, are you kidding me? No. I wouldn't even... I can design you a new sign-up flow. An angry one. Can I do... Actually, I would do wonder what therapeutic design thinking would be like. So I was talking about remission and relapse. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I learned there was that for the kind of people who are there, you won't get better. Like, it won't ever just go away, and you won't be fixed. And those are just bad words in the first place.
Yeah.
But you get taught a lot of regulation tools. You get taught to understand and notice things a lot better. And that there are a variety of ways that you can help yourself and that others can help you that are more effective than others just being concerned and saying, you should do something.
Are you okay?
And then, right. And then so it can get to the point where you're like, can you get me an ice pack, please? Because I think this time an ice pack is really going to help. And the thing that they taught me was that you will relapse, like you will do great, and then you will relapse. And then our goal is that those relapses will become less frequent, and they will become less intense, and that they will not last as long. And the thing that I've seen, especially with stuff like depression and anxiety, is that when I don't care enough, I can write again. And right now I am in one of my, being terrified of writing phases.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have not written in my newsletter for a few months now. And then, so then all of that fear builds up. So it's been, I've written a lot on the internet. And sometimes it is easy and sometimes it's hard. I have been very lucky in that 99.99999% of the time, I've not had to take any shit for it.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly lucky about that, and not just not taking shit for it, not having taken shit for it, but also it opened up a whole bunch of opportunities.
Yep.
So we ripped the mental health bandaid off. Let's talk about stupid walks for your stupid mental health.
Yeah. So
for those of you who don't follow Dan on the social medias, he posts selfies of himself taking walks for his mental health. Stupid walks.
Stupid walks.
Stupid mental health. And it is one of my favorite things. So how did that come to be?
I have poor impulse control.
Good.
I thought it would be funny. And then I did another. So first they started out, I think, as a bit of accountability.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure who to. And also because it's social media, so there's always like that underlying performative, like, look at me, look at what I'm doing.
Yeah, I'm struggling with that very much right now, with accountability versus performative behavior. Right. Yeah.
I talked to my therapist about that as well, and we had a fascinating conversation. Because sometimes I do one so that I can post it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I go on a walk because at that time I really feel like I need to go on a mental health walk. And then I think I pretty much did do them for external validation, because it's like amongst a lot of my friends, a lot of people I know and a lot of people who follow me know that going on a mental health walk is a good thing and is a helpful thing. So it's kind of like, if you post that you're going on a mental health walk, you must be in a pretty shitty cesspit of the internet if your replies are, go fuck yourself, what are you doing? Right. And it's more likely that people are going to say, hey, well done, good job, you got out of the house, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
So it was probably some of that, like, hey, I want a pat on the back for doing something that is hard and doing something that other people also understand is hard. And then I would be lying if I said there wasn't also some mugging for the camera to try and look as annoyed about the whole thing as possible.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're angrily going on a stupid mental health walk sometimes because it fucking works. What is up with that? Which again felt like a particular subtype or personality. You know, growing up with computers in the 80s and 90s, you're like, oh no, I wish I didn't have to cart around my brain in this stupid body. I wish I didn't have to think about my body. I hate my body. Why can't I just be my brain?
Yeah.
And then being forced to consider that maybe your body is important and it would be good to have something that can carry your brain around in as well as possible. I have been very encouraged about the people who now send me pictures of them going on stupid mental health walks. Mm-hmm. And the conversation with my therapist was along the lines of, so I went on this thing and I posted it and people replied and I liked it and I'm not sure if it's good if I do it for the external validation. And then my therapist, I'll kind of summarize, was like, are you fucking ridiculous? like, you're doing something that is objectively good for you, that multiple professionals have told you that is good for you. There's peer-reviewed research that says that this is good for you. You get something out of it. You're inspiring other people to do it, and they're telling you that they've done it, and you think that this, and you have found a way to feel bad about this. Mm-hmm. And then we had a more productive conversation about that than kind of the accusatory one. But, you know, even thinking about it that way was like, isn't it interesting how easily and quickly something can be turned around in your head? So then he was like, well, you can look at the posts from people who say, like, all they're saying is thank you, right? Mm-hmm. Or all they're saying is good job. Like, if you just read it for what it is, if you look at the evidence, then, and also thoughts are just thoughts and they just go away. They're not true.
I was going to say, if I have to be doing the mental health things that I'm doing for myself for the right reasons, I am never going to be in a better place. I have to do them for whatever reason I'm able to do them. And so just as someone who appreciates your example, I'm going to say thank you again.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Rick, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to touch on because I really appreciate it as well. And, for folks, because I know language is very important to you and you kind of like categorizing these activities specifically as stupid mental health walks, like
for his maybe stupid mental health.
Yes. For his stupid mental health.
But because of my stupid brain.
Yes.
Yeah. And because they stupid work.
Vehicle that you want to be better for your brain.
Yeah.
Maybe just describe, like, are there certain aspects that make a stupid mental health walk different than just going for a walk? Like, is there a, like, if I'm walking to do something, does that disqualify it from being a stupid mental health walk because there's an intended outcome from it? Like, or is it just anytime I'm able to get out and get active, it helps my mental health from your perspective?
From my perspective, it's a continuum and it's not discrete.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I would say that it is better if someone replied to me with a t-shirt that I think they have it's like a catch to 5K type thing, and their shirt is like, any distance is a good distance. So yep. I'm like, yes, I totally get behind that, especially if you're at a stage where, you know, getting outside for 5 minutes, getting outside for 3 minutes, and the any N is a good N. Perspective. Mm-hmm. I'm friends. I think I'm friends. I'm definitely internet friends. with a well-known writer, and we were talking about Pomodoro. I was talking about my ADHD coach made me get these sand timers so that I can do shit.
Mine is right there.
Yeah, and they go down to 1 minute, right? And she's like, 1 minute. And then there's this person, I have multiple of their books in my bookcase to my right. And they're like, they set a Pomodoro timer for 5 minutes. Or no, wait, no, for 30 seconds to start writing. Wow. Sometimes. And I'm like, are you, like, 30 seconds? Now I feel less bad. So I'm very much on any distance is less distance is good distance. I feel better if I don't look at my phone mm-hmm. while I'm doing it. I honestly feel like, especially I became such of a shut-in during COVID. Like I didn't go to my co-working space anymore, which meant that I didn't have to walk or ride a bike. You know, we didn't go to stores anymore. So it's entirely conceivable that I could spend, you know, many, many hours in, you know, days just without leaving the house. Mm-hmm. So even just getting outside and just getting the sunlight helps. The types of walks that we did in IOP were also kind of around noticing. So just looking at things differently. And there's like grounding techniques that like sometimes work, like, you know, what are five things that you can see? What are four things that you can hear and stuff like that?
Five senses check-in is one of my all-time personal favorites. A day goes by that I haven't used it. I'm not really sure what's happening.
And also because I find that at least if I'm genuinely angrily doing a stupid or resentfully doing a stupid mental health walk within about a minute, it's a really good reminder of how emotions aren't permanent and they can just go, because suddenly within about a minute, it's like, oh wait, where did that go? I'm suddenly on a different thing, you know, in most cases. So, I'm very much on the, annoyingly, apparently your body influences what your brain feels and does.
The brain is more important. Why does the body get a say?
Yeah. So yeah, I think it doesn't, I think in the grand, I don't think the reason matters.
Okay, cool. Thank you. That's helpful.
All right. I'm just going to go ahead and say I've been trying to be mindful of the length of our episodes and taking up our guests' time. And we are at the point where we need to switch over to our lightning round.
Okay.
If everyone is ready, because I feel like we could talk to Dan about any one of the topics that we've broached for another 6 hours. So I will go ahead and formally ask you to come back on the show and ask you if you will be our stupid mental health walk expert.
Sure. I'll be the stupid mental health walk correspondent.
Yes, the correspondent. Senior correspondent for stupid mental health walks.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Daily show style.
Yes, exactly. That is where our senior correspondents come from. All right. I'm going to dive into the questions. I'm going to ask you four. I'm going to roll. First, we're going to roll this die.
Okay.
Over here, it's behind my tea.
And I'm supposed to answer quickly.
Yes. What? But if you get, go ahead.
It's nine.
Nine. So if you get stuck,
okay,
you're allowed to pass.
Oh, okay.
But we will come back to it.
Okay.
So there's no time limit. Okay. So you can't avoid the question, but you can at least press pause.
All right. Just jotting down your additional question.
Cool. This is a change to the format, by the way. Before we would have this awkward pause after four questions. So now we've got, now it's going to flow. Just five questions. Boom, boom,
I'm working
boom.
On it. Yeah. I'm working on it. Okay. Nice. Dan, what one habit would you like to pick up over the next year?
Oh, yeah. Wait, no. I thought I had a really quick answer for it, which was, I want to be able to run Cat5 cabling and patch holes, but that's not a hat. I mean, if that were a habit, then that would be dangerous in a way.
It would be dangerous.
So I'll say a habit is I want to be better at putting away stuff after I do DIY.
Nice.
Put stuff DIY away episode. As soon as I finish using it.
I struggle with that as well.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Question number two. Would you like to know a lot about one thing or a little bit about a lot of things?
A lot about one thing.
Okay.
Okay.
What do you need from the grocery store?
Gluten-free bread.
Oh, are you gluten-free too?
No.
Oh, okay.
But someone in this house is.
Okay. Gluten-free bread. New Cascadia, by the way, in case you're not. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
New Cascadia. France stuff is all right, but the New Cascadia stuff is.
New Cascadia stuff is legit, as long as you toast it or something.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Question number four. Would you like to survive the zombie apocalypse?
Yes, because I think it'd be hilarious.
Yes!
because the joke is like, okay, unless I learn a whole bunch of new skills, then what use is being able to write a good PowerPoint strategy?
There you go.
But we send our kids to our kids go to outdoor school, so they know how to build shelters and start fires and things. So they are our a lot of people have kids who look after them in old age, and we decided that needs to include the zombie apocalypse. So
I love your household. Your family is fantastic. This is
99% my wife.
It is very practical. Yeah. She's delightful. I've never even met her, and I can tell you she's delightful. All right. Question number five. What did 5-year-old Dan want to be when he grew up?
I'm going to have to say writer now, because I kind of painted myself into that corner earlier.
You did. Yeah, you did. All right. You have mastered the lightning round. 5 questions. You flew right through them.
Yeah.
And now I say, thank you so much for joining us on this show. We have been super excited. Like, you don't know this, but we've been whispering about getting you on the show since the very early days. When can we bring Dan on?
I told my kids last night that they were going to have to be quiet this morning because I was going to be doing a podcast, and our 10-year-old was, oh wow, you're going to be like, so, because they look at YouTube now, they're aware.
Sure.
And it's like, what? Yeah. Which one are you going to be on? It's like, oh, it's this thing called Mildly Interesting People. And then he looked at me and goes, that's right, you are mildly interesting.
No, you're wildly interesting. You let him know the Mildly Interesting People said that you're wildly interesting. All right. At this point, I ask Rick to wrap this up with a pretty bow.
Sure. Happy to. Dan, I was lucky enough to work in close proximity with you for a number of years and had the chance to not only engage with you professionally, but also on a purely creative level from time to time. And I will always cherish those memories. I didn't even bring up gamification. I wasn't gonna try.
You just did. Yeah. Next just time. Brought it up.
But I just always found you to be genuine, forthright, and absolutely passionate about whatever it is that has your current focus. And I've just been really thankful to follow along in your journey, not only about working through your mental health, but also just like you as a person and what you bring to our internet and to this world. Like, you are a writer. You are putting powerful thoughts out there, and I will be forever thankful for it. So thank you for joining us on the show. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks, Cammie.
Thanks, Dan.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye.